This week on Your Western Context, Bill C-11 allows the CRTC to regulate user content. Alberta NDP volunteers are demeaned, and panic buying ensues after Trudeau's gun freeze. Also, Trudeau trolls Canadians by creating policy in response to the U.S. This is Western Context, episode 273, recorded Saturday, June 11th, 2022. The Greatest Gun Salesman. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself have returned this week, and we do have news to discuss this week, news that once again has the potential to change the entire landscape of how you actually get your news in Canada.
Yes, indeed. Lots of news this week, starting off with the Bill C-11 changes that are happening that may very well affect how we deliver Western Context to you. And this is very big news, along with a bunch of other news that have the potential to really just change Canada in general as we go going forward, which is why we're here to talk about this very important news and how it relates to you specifically.
And we've been doing this since 2017 here at Western Context. The entire business that we have is to seek out and remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the media, whether it's online, on print, on the TV, anywhere you get your news, really. And in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And as Patrick mentioned, we're going to be starting with a story about the media and Bill C-11 Canada-wide. And if you want to follow along, we have show notes at westerncontext.ca.
Now, for those who don't know, Bill C-11 is also known as the Online Streaming Act, and it is the updated version of Bill C-10, which was first introduced last year by former Heritage Minister Stephen Guilbeault. Of course, Bill C-10 died when Trudeau called his unnecessary election at the end of last year, which forced Canadians to the polls and really returned a result that wasn't much different from the result that we had back in 2019. And now Bill C-10's barely updated version, C-11, is now being spearheaded by current Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez. Now, Bill C-11 expands the Broadcasting Act that grants the CRTC the regulatory powers over radio and television to cover all audiovisual content on the internet, including content on platforms like TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, as well as podcast clients, which would include Western Context. Now, under Bill C-11, all platforms hosting audiovisual content that are not specifically excluded must make financial contributions to producing officially recognized CanCon, or Canadian content, which is currently defined by a 1980s-era point system built around legacy media broadcast media before the internet was really a thing. Now, does that system support Canadian storytelling and culture? Well, it's uneven at best, because in recent years, productions about U.S. President Donald Trump and the English Tudors, just for example, have been greenlit as Canadian content, while productions of iconically Canadian stories like The Handmaid's Tale and Turning Red have not really met the standard. Now, under Bill C-11, platforms must also make CanCon discoverable by filling our feeds and search results with a mandatory quota of official CanCon, or face stiff financial penalties from the CRTC. Now, CanCon support currently largely excludes small and digital-first Canadian content creators. Now, while Bill C-11 instructs the CRTC to review CanCon definitions, there is little guidance on how to actually do so, and no certainty for when it will complete its review or whether digital creators will be appropriately included in future support. Now, Bill C-11 also gives the CRTC unprecedented regulatory authority to monitor all online audiovisual content. This power extends to penalizing content creators and platforms, and through them, content creators that fail to comply. Now, however, despite all of this, and despite Bill C-11 including all of this, both Pablo Rodriguez and representatives from the CRTC have been quick to downplay what the governmental agency would be able to control, despite the sweeping powers that the bill would actually grant the CRTC. Now, the CRTC would be able to implement discoverability requirements, forcing platforms to promote Canadian content to users, but not to impose standards on the content of what users post, such as rules around obscenity. Now, this is directly from the House of Commons Heritage Committee. Now, Rachel Frenette, who is the CRTC General Counsel and Deputy Executive Director, said that, quote, user-uploaded content can be the subject of some authority by the Commission, but argued that the CRTC's powers in relation to social media platforms and user-uploaded content are actually quite narrow. For instance, the CRTC said that they can't impose any rules around standards of programming on user-uploaded content. Frenette said, quote, the Commission could, for example, issue certain rules with respect to discoverability. It could perhaps issue rules to respond to certain concerns on accessibility. Now, content creators have warned that discoverability provisions for Canadian content would harm the creators that the bill aims to help. If Canadian content is shown to users who aren't interested in it and thus don't engage with it, the algorithms will then downgrade that content, they argue. Now, many Canadian YouTubers have traveled to Ottawa to speak out against the bill, which many say has been written by people who really don't know how the internet works. Now, earlier in the day at the committee, Justin Tomchuk, who runs two large YouTube channels, told the committee that the bill would potentially destroy his channel's international visibility, and 97% of his viewers are international. Tomchuk said, quote, Bill C-11 implies vague changes to these platforms to prioritize Canadian content to Canadians, but it would in turn deprioritize Canadian content to an international audience. The social media platforms cannot allow Canadian content to enjoy heightened exposure to Canadians without detracting exposure internationally, as it creates an uneven playing field on the platform. Less Canadian content will be shown globally as a result. And that is our quote of the week this week, because it really just shows how prioritizing Canadian content in Canada is going to deprioritize Canadian content in the rest of the world. And at the end of the day, spreading our Canadian stories worldwide should be the result of what a strong and vibrant culture does. But this bill is seeking to almost be an isolationist bill when it comes to Canadian culture. Now, Tomchuk said that the bill needs to make the distinction between paywalled premium distributors such as Netflix and user-generated social media platforms such as YouTube. Now, Canadian Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez appeared before the Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage just a couple days ago, and he used the opportunity to defend Bill C-11 with the assurances that concerns about the inclusion of user content within the bill were unfounded. Now, the denials of the content regulation ring hollow as his defense falls apart on close examination of the bill itself. Now, numerous witnesses, including digital creators, internet platforms, and industry associations, have all expressed concerns about the issue. Now, rather than respond to them, Rodriguez and the government have implausibly denied that the issue exists at all. Now, Rodriguez relied on at least three claims yesterday with respect to user content. First, he simply contradicted his own CRTC chair, stating that Bill C-11 does not regulate user content. In fact, Rodriguez was asked directly by Liberal MP Anthony Housefather on the issue. Housefather said, quote, when it comes to Section 4.2, we've heard a lot of comments again about what is regulated or what is not regulated. Can you clarify again that content is not regulated? And Rodriguez very strongly replied, absolutely, it is not. Now, Rodriguez's claim is inconsistent with what CRTC Chair Ian Scott told the same committee just the week before when he said that Section 4.2 allows the CRTC to prescribe by regulation user-uploaded content subject to very explicit criteria. That is also in the act. Now, the government's continued insistence that the bill does not do what it plainly says it does seems like a classic case of gaslighting. But Rodriguez doesn't stop there. He relies yet again on the claim that, quote, platforms are in, users are out. While this is true in the sense that users are not regulated like platforms due to an exception in the bill, the truth is that the bill regulates indirectly what it cannot do directly. In other words, users may not be called before the CRTC, but their content still falls under CRTC regulation, with platforms tasked with the enforcement. Both YouTube and TikTok, the two best-known user content platforms, have provided the committee with submissions that make it clear that as currently structured, platforms and user content both face regulation with Bill C-11. Now, Rodriguez also emphasized that the bill was limited to commercial user content, noting that there are three criteria for the CRTC to consider whether the content falls within the act. Now, the minister referred to content that generates revenue and was asked repeatedly how much revenue is needed in order to qualify. He refused to provide the actual number, instead stating that there was no threshold and that the CRTC would consider all the criteria. So once again, he's dodging what the actual act says and trying to say that the act is doing what it's not. Now, TikTok did not appear before the standing committee as part of its Bill C-11 study, but one of the world's most popular user-generated content sites did issue a warning that even Rodriguez can't ignore. If the bill becomes law, quote, any video on TikTok that uses music could be subject to regulation under the Broadcasting Act. TikTok's analysis picks up where Rodriguez left off as he sought to downplay the effects of the bill. And despite the persistent denials, TikTok's submission to the committee leaves little doubt that any Canadian who uses TikTok to create a video with music backing will find their content caught by the bill. Now, make no mistake, Bill C-11 is a dangerous bill that will change the way Canadians interact with the internet as long as it's in force. Now, while the desire to preserve Canadian culture in an increasingly globalized world is an admirable trait, as is so often the case, Trudeau is tackling the issue with all the subtlety of a sledgehammer and still somehow manages to completely whiff on fixing the problems that the bill is meant to address. Instead, it harms Canadian content creators, Canadian organizations, Canadian internet users, i.e. everyone in Canada, as well as the international audiences of very popular and successful Canadian media creators. The bad news is that the mainstream media rarely talks about just how dangerous this bill actually is, because they are really the only ones that will actually benefit from it. And that's why your support for Western Context is so important, that we can deliver the news that matters to you.
And with this, we see two direct problems and, of course, a number of problems under the hood with all this. The first one, of course, is that the government is engaging in bringing this bill forward, and they're doing it in such a way that is going to be inherently destructive at the end, and it's really only going to benefit the largest media creators. And there's a portion of the public that this plays to, and we're talking specifically about the very core downtown 416 Toronto area that is always going to be a Liberal or NDP stronghold, and of course certain areas of cultural Quebec that wants to see the government push really hard on this Canadian content issue. That's problem number one. And problem number two is the consistent deferral to the CRTC on all this in terms of setting what the guidelines are going to look like and what the regulation is going to look like for this, because we've talked about time and time before about the CRTC here and how they have such an impact in what our wireless landscape looks like, in what our media landscape looks like, in determining what channels on your TV get mandatory carriage by all the cable providers and which ones do not. There was a very clear case of this happening back in the early 2010s when the Sun News Network wanted to get off the ground, and they were seeking mandatory carriage but because they couldn't get mandatory carriage, they were relegated to the areas of where you'd find your premium TV channels, like the History Channel and such. And as a result of that, Canadians missed out on having a fourth major news network. And there's a lot of things that have happened in the intervening years on the internet, in the Canadian internet, specifically news landscape, that can be traced back directly to that. And the story where this all comes back to C11 is that if C11 goes forward and these sorts of changes go on, we're going to start seeing that exact same thing happening, except this time it's going to be happening with the independent media creators online rather than a news organization, and the CRTC is just going to get their fingers in that. And, well, we know from times past that things could have gone better in that case.
Yes, exactly. We've seen that the CRTC has protected the biggest media companies, and that, of course, includes the internet providers like TELUS, Bell, and Rogers. It's protected the biggest media organizations such as CTV, Global, and even the CBC, which already gets funding from the government to operate. And because of its protection of the biggest news companies, it's made it very difficult for smaller news organizations to actually get off the ground. That's why when you read Canadian news online, you'll find that most of it is just the same, or that it's been parroted, because it's all being run from the same organization, the Canadian Press, of course. And I think that that's something that's led to a homogenization of news in Canada, which is why when you read up on something, you'll only be able to find one viewpoint that's been parroted across all of the media platforms. And that's why independent media is so important in this day and age, especially when it comes to the internet, because you're able to find news that many mainstream outlets won't actually talk about. I mean, that's why Western Context exists in the first place, is so that we cover the news that the media doesn't. And Bill C-11 is one piece of news that all of the mainstream media have completely ignored, because it's going to change them for the better, but it's going to change everyone else for the worse, because it's going to allow the CRTC to not just regulate the news organizations, but it's going to get their fingers into TikTok, YouTube, any other platform that has news or Canadian content on it, such as podcasts, even Facebook news. You know, all sorts of things would be under the law on this, and it's going to cause a huge backlash that's going to isolate Canada culturally, especially online. And it's going to allow the government to really regulate what goes on. And there are countries out there in the world, such as Germany and Australia, that have very strong laws against what happens online. And they're widely decried for that, because it's a major lack of freedom in countries that otherwise have very strong Western democratic traditions. And I think that that's something that Canada is moving towards with Trudeau's latest plans. And I think that that's something that really should worry everyone, because it's something that we wouldn't expect to have to need in Canada. And because of our large tradition of freedom and democracy in Canada, that's something that a lot of Canadians wouldn't expect. And because this story about Bill C-11 has flown so far under the radar, I think that many people wouldn't even realize that our freedom is getting taken away from us without us even realizing it. And if people can't talk about it online, which Bill C-11 is aiming to clamp down on, then that's just going to make the problem worse.
Yeah, and of course you're not going to be able to hear about it in the media. And it's if you tell this story to an American, they would be absolutely floored by what would be happening with this. And it's that reason alone, amongst others, why we're talking about this here out Western Context. And if you want to help us do that, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And there you can support the podcast, starting for as little as $2 a month, price of a cup of coffee. You'll be helping us remove the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in Patreon contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month. This article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, we'll do a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And of course, if you want to support us in another way, we do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And we're going to move on to Alberta right now. And this is an important story because a good chunk of the media focus in the province has been focused on the UCP and their leadership race and what that's turning out to look like. And the reason we want to, of course, talk about this is that Jason Kenney, as Premier of Alberta, is doing the people's business. But our job here is also to have a look at what's happening with the other party leaders. And that's the thing. A lot of the media has been focused on the UCP leadership race with the idea that maybe this might be distracting from what the UCP is doing. And there's been countless stories on that. But in reality, there's still the Premier, Jason Kenney, and the cabinet that is carrying out the day-to-day business, minus the sole cabinet minister so far that has stepped down to run for the UCP leadership race, Travis Tays, of course. But there's a common misconception among those who just watch the news and don't watch politics frequently in the province, who think that ordinary party members have no influence in Alberta, when in reality they're the ones who decided that Jason Kenney should leave. And it doesn't work that way in all political parties. And with that, with this story, we're going to be talking about the NDP. That party has minimal grassroots involvements in terms of setting policy, and it's tied heavily to the federal party run by Jagmeet Singh. Now, this week, of course, we have the news that the culture in the Alberta NDP does not provide a safe environment for some workers, and there's a culture of disrespect and mistreatment of volunteers and workers. The Alberta NDP are said to be cycling through volunteers and have lost some constituency association presidents. And for those who are unfamiliar with how politics works at the riding level, these are the people who do most of the organization at the local level and, in effect, organize in the lead up to an election to make sure that each electoral district is going to be able to get up and go next spring when it's election time. Now, these are the people on the ground, and they're realizing what the NDP is truly about when they say, this party should be run by the members, but the party is a party of a few elite staffers. And with this week, 15 NDP riding presidents and regional executives called for an independent investigation into this pattern of mistreatment and sketchy candidate nomination processes. And looking at the mistreatment on its own first, it's characterized as with staff being rude, belittling, or condescending to volunteers and candidates, as well as some people actually being shouted at in meetings. Now, NDP leader Rachel Notley said that there are two sides to every story and the process needs to be followed. And from this, the NDP is in a similar boat to when UCP grassroots organizers started raising concerns about pandemic restrictions. And you'll note that the only difference here is that one was covered heavily in the media, day in, day out, and amplified and used to divide and wedge the province, whereas one is not. And if you're listening to Western Context here, there's a very real chance that you haven't even heard anything about this story with the NDP this week. Now, the NDP also has a party nomination process that is anything but democratic, and political parties are traditionally able to do this in the Westminster style of democracy. The NDP, Liberals, and Greens to an extent do this at the federal level. The parties in the UK do this as well, and they tightly control who can run in their nominations. But the one big difference is that most parties in Canada on the political right, like the UCP, the Federal Conservatives, and such, they're much more open with their nomination processes, similar, of course, to how those nomination processes work in the United States. Now, for the NDP, some candidates have been waiting to have their applications vetted for over a year, while others have been processed very, very quickly. Constituency association presidents also say they're being left out of the loop on specific nomination races, and they feel like their input is being ignored. And this is an important thing to point out, because anybody who is effectively in charge of a constituency association needs to have a close relationship with the party and ultimately, at the end of the day, a close relationship with the nominee once that person has decided who's going to be running in that area. Now, the same thing can also be said to volunteers who have said that they also feel like they're just being brand ambassadors at a retail outlet. Multiple volunteers and candidates that discuss this issue with the media feel that the party is doing nothing on this and is just trying to make it all go away. And if we back up a year, two, or three, and we'll see that these are all the exact same allegations that were made towards the UCP in the 2019 race, and of course, during the era of pandemic restrictions, you could, in effect, take the same story, put the UCP in place of the NDP, and you'd find this anytime there was a discussion about internal party matters in the UCP. But we only really saw this in a few outlets this week here in the province. And with this, the difference is that the UCP allegations were chosen by the media to be carried and be discussed in the mainstream, and then were even amplified on social media channels. And we all know, of course, what role social media had to play during the pandemic in terms of dividing Canadians even further. And it's at this point we'll share the reality with our listeners that if you're working or volunteering for a political party, you're donating your time and money to help that candidate win, to help the party win, and ultimately help the leader be successful. You hope that you'll be appreciated, but there's no guarantee of that happening. It makes sense that the party should appreciate their volunteers and workers, because that creates more loyal workers and more dedicated workers, hopefully allowing the process to continue and work in a more fluid manner. But the reality is this can happen in any party, and denying that it can and not reporting it in the mainstream media is foolish. And the big story that needs to come from this is that the biggest mistake, if you look back to 2014, 2015, was that the Alberta media did not vet the NDP at the time. There was no real deep digging into the candidates that they ran in that election. There was no deeping into the policies that they ran. And at the end of the day, Albertans were quite honestly surprised when they saw what they implemented. But anybody, of course, who read the platform and knew what the NDP stood for wasn't surprised. You start looking at just the resumes of a few candidates and you see what track they were on. And we could very well be on that same track again, in that the media and Albertans in general aren't paying attention to the NDP here, when in reality, what we see here is in many ways the history repeating itself. And that's why it's so important that this story see the light of day.
Yes, exactly. I think this story is really important in the sense that it's shining a light on something that you don't see very often within political parties themselves, especially opposition parties. And I think that this one story that really didn't receive too much coverage on this one really highlights the power imbalance that can be held within different political parties, especially between the grassroots of the organization as well as the party executive at the very top. And I think that the Alberta NDP does have a lot of policies that are much different from the policies of parties like the UCP, the Federal Conservatives, and even other parties on the federal level that really have much more open and transparent policies that allow their volunteers to have a better say in what's actually going on. And with the NDP, quite clearly they do not. And I think that that's something where people at the individual riding level are not really getting as much input into what's going on as they think they are. And I think that the media is not really talking about this, not just because the NDP are in opposition, but also because the media really wants the NDP to win again in a future election. And I think by not covering it, they're really just kind of glossing over the real story here. And that's something that the media always tends to do, is that they tend to minimize news stories or articles about stories that they don't really want to talk about. And I think that we're seeing this more and more often lately. And I think this is just another example of that.
Yeah, and the classic thing to do in this case would be to ask yourself if there was a case where the grassroots of the NDP became frustrated with Rachel Notley, could they push her out in the same way that the grassroots of the UCP was able to get that leadership vote going against Jason Kenney? Of course, there was going to be a leadership review at the tail end of this mandate, but it was those motions that came specifically from the UCP constituency associations that brought it forward, and it was the grassroots organizing in various regions of the province that got so many people interested to the point where it became a vote of all UCP members rather than just people who would go to Red Deer to cast a vote. And that's the core difference between these two political parties, is that a lot of people just look at the two political parties based on what they do and what their policies are. But in terms of determining who you want to vote for, you should be determining that based on which political party is going to, in effect, provide the most democracy to you. And there's two very, very different options on the table here. And of course, there's politicians at different levels and different colors that are, of course, going to be using any crisis they can to push policy. And we're starting to see the results of that in our second Canada story this week.
Yes, indeed. Our second Canada story this week is talking about the handgun freeze that Trudeau has been putting in. And this happened following the tragic Uvalde school shooting massacre in Texas, as well as the mass shooting in Buffalo earlier in May. And after these two incidents, gun control legislation was being debated once again, not just in the U.S., but in Canada, where such mass shootings are already very, very rare with existing gun control legislation at work. Now, never mind that both shootings were committed using semi-automatic rifles, which are already very highly restricted from purchase in Canada or banned altogether, especially under Trudeau's previous gun ban back in 2020. Well, Trudeau announced his intention to further expand his gun control agenda to further restrict handguns from being sold to the Canadian public, which is expected to be implemented sometime in the fall. Now, Trudeau said in a statement, quote, "One Canadian killed by gun violence is one too many. I've seen all too well the tragic cost that gun violence has had in our communities across the country. Today, we're proposing some of the strongest measures in Canadian history to keep guns out of our communities and to build a safer future for everyone." Trudeau followed up with, quote, "We only need to look south of the border to know that if we do not take action firmly and rapidly, it gets worse and worse and gets more difficult to counter." Now, if we look south of the border, we should note that the U.S., having just under 9 times of the population of Canada, had 163 times as many gun-related deaths in 2020. The two countries cannot really compare, and one should not look to the south of the border to create legislation in Canada. And because of that, you'll see that the approaches to the the issue that is happening in the U.S. Really should not be the same in Canada. Now, because of the gun freeze not taking place immediately, Canadians are now rushing to gun stores and have been since the announcement. Shops have been reported being sold out of pistols after demand surged in the run-up to the freeze, and some stores ran out of stock within days of the announcement. In some places, demand ran so high that customers lined up in the street desperate to acquire a handgun firearm before the ban took place. Jen Levine, who is the co-owner of that hunting store in Ottawa, said, quote, "We sold 100 handguns, or almost our entire stock, in the last 3 days since the Prime Minister announced the freeze. This measure is only going to hurt legal gun owners. It's not going to reduce any of the crime because the bad guys don't follow the rules." Now, handgun owners and those who sell them say that legal requirements to possess and use their weapons are already extremely strict, with mandatory training, stringent storage laws, and their transportation limited between home and the firing range. Now, proponents of gun control say that a federal ban on handguns will lessen accidents and its use in domestic violence incidents, but opponents say that the law will have no impact on the main abuse of handguns, which is their use by criminals who obtain them illegally, with many of those weapons smuggled in from the U.S. Instead, it will make the black market more attractive and guns more valuable. Now, it should be noted that Canada currently has 1 million handguns, and about 2,500 stores currently sell handguns in the country. It's already an extensive process to purchase a handgun in Canada. First, you have to pass the Canadian Firearms Safety Course. That is 16 hours of instruction, followed by a written exam and a practical exam. And after that is complete, you have to wait for your test results to come back from the Chief Firearms Officer. In the meantime, you can download all the forms from the RCMP's website or obtain them from Service Canada for your background check. And in that background check, you're going to have to outline any partners that you've cohabited with for the past 5 years and your spouse's information as well. On top of that, you're going to have to answer questions asking if you've been prescribed any drugs for depression or if you've had a job loss or a divorce in the past 5 years. You're going to also have to provide references that the RCMP should call, and your cohabiting partner or spouse is also going to have to sign off on that last page to say, yes, I'm okay with this individual owning firearms. And then you send that entire package off to the RCMP, and if everything checks out on their end, then they will send you your firearms license in the mail. Then you can go to a retailer who is licensed to sell handguns, and you have to bring your possession and acquisition license that the RCMP sends you with you to the store to check. Now, according to Ryan Simper, who is in charge of business development for Select Shooting Supplies in Cambridge, Ontario, he says, quote, "Firearm owners feel like they're some of the most responsible citizens in this country because the RCMP has put their trust in them to give them their license. So when somebody says you can't have any more, they go out and buy. I think it's more of a protest. They're saying that the current government wants to eliminate handgun ownership in this country, and the current government doesn't trust its own citizens. So they're going to go and buy them." Now, if the new law goes through, Simper says, quote, "We'll no longer be able to sell handguns. It is a large part of our business and we'll have to move into something else. I feel more sorry for the smaller shops that are probably going to go out of business because they don't have the ability to make a quick switch into something else." Simper concludes by saying, quote, "It's just targeting the property that's been lawfully acquired by citizens that have been cleared to own by the RCMP already. If our National Police Service says it's okay for me to own a gun, if the National Police Service says it's okay for my customers to own a gun, why is the government against me owning a gun? There is a severe disconnect there. We want safer communities, but I don't think this is the way to do it." Now, politicians continue to misread the tea leaves when it comes to gun ownership. When calling for bans, gun sales typically increase. Now, announcing that a gun would actually be banned in the future only creates unprecedented demand. Trudeau's bill has resulted in exactly what he and so many other gun control advocates often fail to expect, and that is that more people who might have never purchased a gun before will run out and make a purchase. Now, Trudeau's game plan since the beginning of the pandemic has been to restrict Canadians' freedoms across the board. He's afraid of Canadians making decisions for themselves because they might decide something that he doesn't like. That's why he's made any number of limp decisions on Canadian issues that don't actually fix the problem, like inflation, the housing crisis, the opioid epidemic, the pandemic, even First Nations issues. And that's something that the media has not really connected the dots on, and it's why we're here to do what the mainstream media won't.
And it's that connecting of the dots that the media doesn't do. And one thing you don't hear in the media about the gun story is that if somebody owns a handgun, you can't even carry it loaded to the range. You have to carry it unloaded. You have to carry the ammunition in a separate case, and then you can only load it once you're safely at the range. And that's something that most Canadians don't know, because the media jumps in on the open carry culture that's prevalent in many U.S. states. And because of that, they go with that same narrative and try to apply it to Canada. But nobody actually talks about how restrictive the firearms process here is in this country, and what most of the firearms that are used and discharged day to day are for. And for anybody wondering what that is, of course, that's farmers protecting livestock, and of course hunters who are doing that in the country. And of course they're not hunting with handguns and such. They have different rifles, some of which were actually targeted by the gun ban in 2020. And when you start to look at all this, it becomes clear that the government is just doing this to make waves and not necessarily push substantive policy. So
yeah, exactly. And this is something that we've seen, is that some are even calling Trudeau the best gun lobbyist there is in the country, because of how many handguns have been sold since he said that he was going to ban him. And I think that that's something that should be noted, is that there are many more guns on the streets now because of him saying that he's going to ban guns. And I think that's something that should be noted, is that it's done the complete opposite of what his bill was meant to do. And we've seen this so often lately with Trudeau's legislation agenda, is that it's done the opposite of what the bill is supposed to actually fix, or the problem that it's supposed to address. And I think that there's been so much discussion out there from gun control advocates, as well as people who own guns or sell guns, and what they've said. And I think there's a lot of literature out there to read, whether you're on one side or the other. I think it's safe to say that Trudeau has not fixed the issue of handguns whatsoever, because the main issue is criminals getting them imported from the U.S. So if he really wanted to tackle the handgun issue, of which there really isn't one in Canada to begin with, but if he did want to tackle criminals using handguns and gun violence, then he should be targeting the border crossings near the major cities, such as Toronto or Vancouver, and, you know, try and increase funding for CBSA to actually track the border crossings, and to, you know, cut down on the illegal guns that are coming into the country from the U.S. Instead, he's targeting legal gun owners who, as we've mentioned before, have already been vetted to own by the RCMP. And either it means he doesn't trust the RCMP's guidance on this, or he doesn't trust the gun owners completely. But it means that what he did is not really helping the situation whatsoever.
Yeah, and you could almost call that a very extreme vetting process, to the point where it's might be causing more problems than it is. And we're going to go into our firing line on that right now. And this is a story that the media misses, or something that's not presented just right in the media. And what this is something that was missed, and it's that same connection of the dots on all of the different stories that the federal government has tried to act on that hasn't produced any real substantive policy changes. And we've talked, of course, before about the 2019 and 2021 elections, where there were successful wedges used by Justin Trudeau against the opposition. It was abortion, social issues in 2019, and vaccine status in 2021. And we see this week. We're going to continue on this track here. We saw this starting in the National Post, where the author of this piece compares the Trudeau government to a troll farm. And the issue that's pointed out is that the policies presented do little to enact change. And these are the policies that are expressly divisive. We've, of course, talked about actual policies that were meant to try and change things on the economy and such, and those did not work. But the issue that's pointed out, aside from these policies not bringing forward the change they want, is that all they seek to do is rile up Trudeau's base and provoke the Conservatives into adopting opposing ideas or twisting themselves into a pretzel. So with that, let's start with gun control that we were just talking about and how that's been done. We, of course, just talked about how the gun policy only emerges after the horrific Uvalde shooting in the U.S., and we don't have that exact issue here in the country. And what's more, this is just a freeze policy on handguns, which means that more can't be sold. And this has actually caught the eye of some people south of the border, this policy, just in terms of how absurd it is, specifically in the Wall Street Journal, which is one of the big, big circulating papers in the U.S. They encouraged Justin Trudeau to run for Congress, pointing out that in Toronto, where there are 36,832 firearms licenses, there are strict laws on how you can carry the handgun that we just talked about. But they also say, rightly, that according to the Toronto Police, 85% of the guns used in crimes there are trafficked in from the U.S. Once again, something else we knew. The firearms legislation also includes the so-called red and yellow flag laws that are redundant here because of that extreme vetting process for background checks that are in place, the wait times, and there are, of course, multiple angles on that process at which the police can get involved if they need to. And when it comes to the gun control issue, Trudeau's policy just plays well in the media here because it's, once again, the media importing those American problems and allowing the government here to act on it, even though it's not what's needed in Canada, though it might be what some American progressives want, a removal on the constitutional right in the U.S. to bear arms. But it's not just gun control, because we also saw the exact same thing when the U.S. Supreme Court draft opinion on overturning Roe versus Wade was leaked. And for those who are unaware, Roe versus Wade was the Supreme Court decision made that de facto legalized abortion in the U.S. Some states still put limitations on it, and this caused politicians across the country and the media to push for a similar move here in this country. When there's no law in the books regarding it, we're in much the same situation here where there's no restrictions. There was just a ruling made by the Supreme Court that said it's not illegal, and as a result, they're carried out in this country. And the U.S. has reached a crisis point on this issue. There was actually a story that really wasn't talked about all that much in the U.S., and this is a horrid example of where we could be heading if we continue down this path of using policies to wedge one part of the population against another. It almost happened this week where there was a foiled assassination attempt of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh this past week. And effectively, the police were able to stop the perpetrator before he got close enough to his house, thankfully, but the person made their way out from California and sought to kill the Supreme Court Justice because he's a conservative on the court. And in the U.S. and in Canada, the story flew completely under the radar due to the media circus of the live primetime January 6th riot congressional hearings. Now, this is the point that the U.S. is at, and for political gain, all these things happen in that country. And if we look back to Canada, Justin Trudeau is just emulating that and pushing us further in that direction and moving us into what's happening in the U.S. And all these issues, from gun control to the abortion issue, could have been acted on by the Prime Minister, where he had a majority from 2015 to 2019. He could have passed abortion legislation easily, and he could even do it now with the support of the NDP and maybe even some conservatives with the right framing. And these are just two issues so far, gun control and abortion. We also saw the same thing with the ban on conversion therapy, which should have happened before the last election, but was used as a wedge issue to try and get the conservatives on the opposite side. They voted for the ban, effectively taking that issue off the table. And we can go on and on through this list of the government putting policies forward that are just designed to rile up either their base or the opposing base and use it as a way to keep turning up the heat on the political discourse in this country. We saw this when the government kept the flags on Parliament Hill last year at half staff, following the horrors of the residential schools being made mainstream. There was also the case for the natural resources industry and pipelines, where those were used against those in Western Canada as convenient wedge issues. Then there were vaccinations in the last election campaigns where Canadians who weren't vaccinated were deemed as undesirable by policy and are still banned from traveling even within the country on plane or train when you look at what's happening in the country. Most regional COVID restrictions have been lifted. And the silly part about all this is that Trudeau was against mandatory vaccination until there was a political opportunity on this in the last election. This provided an opportunity for both protesters in the campaign and also in January to create that wedge, which was done successfully. And some could even say that this propelled Justin Trudeau to another minority government with this. And this is exactly what the Prime Minister wants. It's his brand of politics that was honed in his opposition years and brought him to power in 2015. And it's not going to end. And as a result of this, the country is suffering as a result, and the media needs to take note of this and change their reporting on the actions that Ottawa takes, or else this will only get worse before it gets better, and it will start looking a lot more like the U.S., despite that's what many in Canada do not want.
Yes, this is one thing that many Canadians do, and that's they constantly look to the U.S. for comparisons, whether we're doing better than them about something or they're doing better than us about something, it really doesn't tend to matter. But Trudeau is personifying the worst of that trait by crafting legislation policy that's based on what's happening in the United States versus what's actually happening in Canada and what the problems are in Canada that actually need to be addressed. And I think we saw this with the abortion issue, which came up only after the U.S. Supreme Court draft was leaked about Roe versus Wade. We saw this with the gun control policy back in 2020 after U.S. gun-related shootings. We're seeing it again this year after U.S. gun-related shootings. And we're, you know, seeing a whole bunch of legislation that the Prime Minister has put out just in response to what's happened in the U.S. And I think that that's something that got notice with the Ottawa convoy protests as well, is that a lot of the rhetoric coming from the government was that they were trying to not turn it into the U.S. Capitol storming that happened a year and a half ago. And the situations were not even comparable at all, because there was no plan to storm the parliament buildings. There was no plan to storm any government buildings in Ottawa. There were just a protest that happened on the streets. And I think that that's something that Trudeau has kind of fictionalized in his own mind, is that he's almost running the United States in the sense that he's trying to fix the problems that are happening down there by applying them to Canada. We've seen this so many times this weekend in the last few weeks that it just bears notice that we really need to talk about how the media really isn't mentioning it very much, because the response to U.S. issues is really the central plank of Trudeau's policy platform. And I think that that's something that really just doesn't get talked about enough.
Yeah, and a lot of the Canadians that we talk to are wondering why we have such a U.S.-centric focus on the news here, and why things that happen in Canada are always pointed back to the U.S. And, you know, with that, you would think that the media was secretly angling to have parts of Canada become part of the U.S., and I'm not aware of anywhere in the country that's planning to do that yet, at least. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, it's something that people need to be aware of in looking at the media, is that the media is pushing these angles, and everybody just sees them and they accept them, when in reality, it's causing a lot of division in this country that wasn't here before, and it's something that needs to be fixed. And the sooner the media realizes that, the better off we're all going to be as a country.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that will lead us nicely into our word of the week, which is troll, which is to make a deliberately offensive or provocative post with the aim of upsetting someone or eliciting an angry response from them. And this comes, of course, from a story that we talked about in our firing line, which described Justin Trudeau as the troll farm prime minister, where he's basically just crafting policy that it aims to be provocative and upsetting people that don't agree with Trudeau's policies to begin with. And really, this has been going on ever since he took power back in 2015, is that he's been polarizing the politics and amplifying the divisions within the country and making it so that people are increasingly in one camp or another. And again, that's just doing what is being done in the U.S., on a greater extreme, because you have two camps down there and you either cheer for one sports team or you cheer for the other sports team, and there's no chance you can cheer for both of them at the same time. And, you know, that's happening more and more up in Canada. And it seems like Trudeau is trying to run to be the U.S. president rather than being the prime minister of the country of Canada that he actually is. And I think that that's why troll is a wonderful word of the week, because it kind of encompasses all of the stories, not just the gun ban legislation, but also Bill C-11, which is going to really isolate Canada on the world stage. And also, of course, the reactions to the policies that he's put forward that have been complete reactions to what happens in the U.S.
Yeah, and this is kind of being an angle here at Western Context since the beginning. We, of course, at the beginning, we had the sense of that this is where we were going, but we didn't have as many examples as we do now. And it's really interesting to start to see all these things come into summation with each other. And that's why we do the Word of the Week, to see if we can sum up the week's news in a certain way and tie all the stories together, which you can find at westerncontext.ca. Also, of course, there you can subscribe to the podcast on any podcast listener out there. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We're on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, and more. Visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the stories of the week and, of course, the podcast. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media talks about and a lot that they don't talk about, in covering what the real news is and what matters to you and your fellow Canadians. And with that said, we'll be looking through all the stories, whether you can find them in radio, TV, print, or online, and we will find them and share them with you and give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will be back next week for another episode of Western Context.